Tom Silvani is the son of AFL royalty. And the story of his rape conviction is one of how privilege can protect you to a point. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Welcome to a special episode of The Case Of.
By planning, cunning and strategy.
When Tom Silvani was convicted of rape, the story was everywhere, mostly because until that point it had been a complete secret, thanks to the access the family had to legal help, keeping his name out of the news. In this episode, with the help of ABC reporter Alexandra Alvaro, we're going to look at how Tom's trial is different to the dozens of other rape cases prosecuted around the country each week, and why, in the end, he still went to jail. Alex, welcome back to The Case Of.
Thanks, Stocky. Good to be back.
It is always a pleasure having you here. We have a lot to discuss with this story, particularly for our non-Victorian listeners, explaining who the Silvanis are. But First, what did Tom Silvani do?
So the events centre around the evening of the 13th into the 14th of January of 2024. And so Tom Silvani, his girlfriend Alana, and his childhood friend Anthony, they were having some drinks at Tom's family home. They'd ordered some pizzas. And then later in the night, Anthony and Alana contacted the victim and invited her over too. And we're going to use a pseudonym when it comes to the victim's name. The courts gave her the pseudonym Samantha Taylor.
Okay.
So just to explain the relationship, so the victim was a friend of Alana's. She'd had a casual sexual relationship with Anthony, and she also knew Tom, but they weren't really close. So she comes around after midnight. She'd been at another social engagement beforehand, and while she's there, she and Anthony, Tom's childhood friend, have consensual sex. And then Anthony gets a text from his parents, and they ask him to come home. And so he leaves in an Uber.
Right.
And then once Anthony's gone, Tom opens the door of the room that Samantha is staying in and says that Anthony's Uber has been cancelled and that he was going to come back upstairs soon. And then this is where the deception begins. It's Tom who a short time later comes into her dark bedroom, climbs into the bed and digitally rapes her, pretending to be his friend. Now, Samantha wriggles away and she challenges Tom's identity. She asks him to show her his face with his phone torch. And during these challenges, he rapes her a second time while she's telling him to stop. She breaks free eventually. She tells him, "I know it's you." And then Tom leaves the room. And as he's leaving, she says she sees his hair, which is longer than Anthony's, the person who he was pretending to be. She then texts Anthony, but he says he's back home.
Right. We're going to talk a bit more about kind of what happens after this rape later in the episode. We're also going to go into the detail of what kind of the arguments were presented during the court as this rape charge was prosecuted against Tom Silvani. But before we get to that, Alex, who are the Silvanis? Because in Melbourne, everybody knows this name. As I mentioned, they're kind of AFL royalty.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about who they are? Why this is so high profile?
Yeah, so they're a family tied to the Carlton Football Club. And as you know, in Melbourne, footy is just everything. So Stephen, Tom's dad, played for the Blues in the 80s and the 90s. His dad is Sergio Silvani. He also played for Carlton. And then Stephen's son, Jack, Tom's brother, also played for Carlton. So that's three generations of Silvanis who played AFL, so they're very well known.
Yeah, right.
Tom's mum is Jo Silvani. Her maiden name is Bailey. She's a television personality. She was on Sale of the Century when she was younger, but more recently she's known for her commercials with a very well-known chemist chain.
Yeah, I know the kind of the brand power commercials. I think they were that Jo Silvani did, and that was actually kind of, I think, the first exposure I had to the Silvanis living outside of Victoria for a time. It wasn't until I moved down to Melbourne and lived here that I got that kind of understanding of the weight that this family and this name holds as well. And I mean, you know, you mentioned Anthony as well, Alex, the friend of Tom Silvani. His dad, I think, was a president of Carlton for a period
time
as well. So you've kind of got these, you know, Melbourne power families embroiled in this whole thing. And you talk about how, you know, this rape happened in 2024, but this went to trial last year. But all through that, we couldn't name Tom. Now, Christian Silver, one of the court reporters at the ABC, was writing articles citing a high-profile Victorian family at the time, but we couldn't name Tom because it was all suppressed.
Yeah, so there was a suppression order preventing reporting of his name, and that was granted in 2024 when the charges were laid. And it was granted on mental health grounds. So his lawyers essentially argued that media publicity could make him extremely distressed and put him at risk of psychiatric harm. So despite a very persistent legal challenge from media outlets, the order was granted and maintained by various judges in various courts.
Right. I mean, does this happen in all sexual assault cases? I know we're very careful on, you know, reporting names of victims, identifying victims. Like, is the suppression of the name of people common in these situations?
Yeah, so you're right. We are restricted from reporting the name of the victim. That's not a suppression as such. It's just the rules. You can't report their identity unless they've given written permission.
Right.
And you can't report any information that could identify them. But in terms of the suppression on the name of the offender or the alleged offender, depending what case it is, it's becoming more common for those to be granted on mental health grounds, according to some of the lawyers that we've spoken to. So we spoke to a lawyer who specialises in representing the media for these suppression fights, Justin Quill. He said the granting of these types of orders can also favour people with the money to fight them. So in this case, the Silvanis had two lawyers, which is highly unusual. They had one lawyer to represent them when it came to the criminal trial, and then another lawyer to help them with the suppression.
Yeah, I guess that kind of points to the resources that are available to this family as well,
yeah.
Talking about how high profile they are. You know, you've got generations of football players within that. You know, you've got TV personality as well. So you need money to kind of to wage those fights, I guess. And it's interesting hearing that there's kind of two different lawyers having these fights as well. You know, when I've seen suppressions put in place, there were a number put in place during the trial of Aaron Patterson.
Yep.
They all kind of happened in the same room. You know, it's sort of a matter of course as this is going on, and there's sometimes a bit of discussion about it. It might come back to it later. But yeah, the way this happened with the different challenges and the different appeals to it, yeah, it seems like this has unfolded a bit differently to what I'd witnessed in the past. Let's get into this court case though, because, you know, we talked about suppression, how we couldn't talk about it. This trial did go underway where we couldn't report on anybody's name though. What were some of the arguments made, you know, for or against the guilt of Tom Silvani?
So the prosecution essentially said that this was rape through deception. Tom had posed as his friend, he'd repeatedly lied, and he'd fabricated an Uber receipt to place his friend at the crime scene. The defence, on the other hand, said during the trial that Samantha had gotten it wrong. He didn't rape her, he didn't climb into her bed, he did fake the Uber receipt, but only because he was panicking.
I want to talk about this Uber receipt. This is something that's happened after the rape. Tom Silvani has, what, gotten the Uber receipt?
Obtained it from his friend.
Yep.
And then doctored it in a way to make it look like his friend had left the house later.
Right, so that he was still in the house when these rapes occurred.
Correct.
Okay, got it. And as well as all of this, you know, we're talking about things that have happened after this rape. There was also a phone call from Samantha to Tom Silvani as well, right?
Yeah, so in January, Samantha Taylor reported the matter to police, and then not too long later, there was a recorded pretext call. This is a call between her and Tom Silvani that was recorded by police.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, Tom tells her that Anthony, his friend, was the one who went back in the room, that, you know, there was this Uber receipt and it all matched up. And in sentencing, the judge said that, you know, using these lies, you repeatedly suggested to her that she shouldn't pursue this matter further.
Right. That seems like someone who has resources, who isn't used to consequences, potentially. So, yeah, interesting to hear kind of how that's unfolded following that. I mean, ultimately, the jury finds Tom Silvani guilty of this. And there's actually reporting of all of this that Christian Silva was doing throughout this trial. And I was reading some of the articles, and Christian's referring to this high-profile Victorian family.
That's right.
There's pseudonyms throughout as well.
Yep.
So, yeah, really interesting to see the length that the ABC was going to throughout this to make sure we didn't breach the suppression order, that we didn't identify Tom Silvani throughout that. But while we kind of kept up the suppression order, worked in the best interests of it, online was a totally different story. Like, Tom Silvani's name was everywhere, right?
Yeah, kind of. Like, you didn't really have to search that far to see Tom's name. People were talking about it on social media, on online forums. There were videos on TikTok discussing the reporting on this case, but Tom's name was the top search option.
Right.
In some of these. So people were putting his name in the comments, and I guess it just makes you realise how small Melbourne is. Sometimes we forget that. But in lifting the suppression order, the judge even acknowledged this. You know, it's already out there.
Yeah, right. And when was the suppression lifted?
So it was lifted after the verdict. Mm. It happened pretty late in the day. The judge essentially decided that it was no longer justified after the verdict. The suppression was no longer justified. Tom Silvani was in prison. Prison officers could monitor his mental state and ensure that he didn't self-harm, as they do with other inmates. And he said, you know, eventually the suppression order has to be lifted. It can't go on forever. And at some point, Tom Silvani has to reconcile himself to the reality that he committed these offences and that there's interest in them.
And there are consequences for them as well. You know, something we get before a sentence for a crime is we hear from the victims. We hear these victim impact statements that are read to the court. What did we hear from Samantha, the woman that Tom raped?
Well, Samantha stood up and she told the court about the lasting impacts that the crimes had on her. And she addressed Tom Silvani pretty directly. She said, "Tom Silvani, you raped me not once but twice. You know this, I know this, and now so does everyone else." And she spoke about the ongoing trauma of the attack. She said it was a moment that haunted her every single day. "This was really heartbreaking," she said. I couldn't hug my own dad without leaping out of his arms because I would feel you, that he had forced her into years of healing that she hadn't asked for." So Tom was there via video link. His family weren't in court, or in the courtroom rather, as this statement was being delivered by Samantha. But once the proceedings wrapped that day, they actually spoke to the media outside court and they told journalists that their son was innocent and they would be doing everything in their power, essentially, to clear his name.
Yeah, kind of wild that the parents of Tom Silvani, you know, Stephen and Joe Silvani, weren't in the room to listen what Samantha had to say, but they don't have to be. It's their choice. They can choose to be wherever they are during that process. Alex, you covered the sentencing of Tom Silvani. What was that like?
Well, at this point, the thirst for knowledge about this case had reached fever pitch, and I think the interest was really fueled by the fact that Tom Silvani's identity had been kept secret. I think that almost added to the intrigue. Mm. So the demands on the journalists who were covering this case were pretty intense. But in the end, he was sentenced to 6 years and 2 months with a non-parole period of 3 years and 3 months. And we did have a camera inside the court, which is pretty unusual, but you'll remember that we had a camera inside court for the Patterson sentencing. So the judge's remarks in this case were broadcast live.
Yeah. And Judge Greg Lyon, he doesn't really hold back.
Like, no.
He kind of goes Tom Silvani.
Yeah, he had some pretty scathing remarks about Tom Silvani's behaviour, and we can actually play it for you because we have the recording of the judge's remarks. So he said that Tom Silvani's crimes were marked by planning, cunning and strategy.
"This included setting up the deception involved in telling Ms. Taylor that Mr. LaJuda Chizuba had been cancelled and that he would be returning to the room. Second, the first rape was committed by deception, by you pretending to be Mr. LaJudice. This crime was relatively brief, as Ms. Taylor was able to wriggle away from your hand. Following this, Ms. Taylor challenged you. You committed the second charge of rape over her protests. She was clearly and repeatedly saying, 'Stop.' I take into account that you held her hands until she broke your grip whilst you committed the second act. Then your attempts at deception and deflection continued for over a week after the offending. You tried to encourage your childhood friend, Anthony, to take responsibility for your actions. You dishonestly altered a document to further this deception. And then you continued to lie to Ms. Taylor and use those lies in an effort to both undermine her belief in what you had done and to persuade her not to pursue the matter further. Your conduct towards Samantha was egregious. Your conduct towards Anthony, who had been a lifelong friend, in your own self-interest, was utterly appalling and shameful."
And he actually had some remarks about Samantha, who was in tears for part of the sentencing, and she was being comforted by those around her, and he commended her for her integrity and her courage for coming forward. He said, "I do not like to use the word victim in relation to Ms. Taylor."
"Ms. Taylor read her victim impact statement in court. It is clear that she has found her own voice. It was a heartfelt and eloquent, detailed account of the trauma she continues to feel 23 months after the crimes. The changes to her life have been seismic. A wise judge once observed that the rehabilitation of the survivor of sexual crimes is often harder to achieve than that of the offender. Ms. Taylor's demonstrated courage is, hopefully, a positive sign that she is on the path to recovery. I commend Ms. Taylor for her real integrity and courage in coming forward in person, in court, giving evidence, and then throughout the sentencing process.
That's Judge Greg Lyon in his sentencing remarks during the sentencing of Tom Silvani. And, I mean, Alex, one of the things that stood out for me in this, I mean, you're talking about how there were two rapes that occurred on that night. It was interesting hearing Judge Lyon differentiate them as well in his remarks.
Both crimes in your offending were committed in a period of minutes. Although they were committed close together, the acts of rape must be viewed separately. One was committed under deception and the other over Ms. Taylor's protest with you restraining her hands.
Alex, you mentioned before how Samantha was in the courtroom, kind of being comforted by the friends. I mean, what was the environment like in there?
It was a big courtroom. There was lots of space for all of us journalists. There was, of course, Samantha Taylor and her supporters sitting on one side of the court, but in the same row, all the way at the other side of the court, right next to the door, were the Silvanis. And I saw Joe Silvani, Tom's mother, actually twist her body to look at the victim during a couple of points while those remarks were being read out.
Mm. I mean, there's so much interest in this case in Victoria, Alex, as we've been talking about through this episode. What was it like once the proceedings finished? Because, you know, it's your job to get out there and get statements from the various parties involved, hear if there's anything they need to say. I mean, you know, it's not just you. There's dozens of journalists following this trial. I mean, there must have been just kind of absolute scenes outside.
Yeah, that's right. Pretty much. Well, as I said, the Silvanis were sitting right next to the door. As soon as proceedings finished, they got up and walked out the door. The journalists pretty promptly followed, but by the time I'd gotten out the room, they were nowhere to be seen. So we ran down the stairs, and it was only really a couple of journalists who were able to catch up to them to ask them for comment.
Mm.
They didn't respond to any requests for comment, but Joe Silvani did tell the journalists who had made it there to go away, and she did at one point even push one of the journalists away.
Yeah, right. I mean, we heard from the Silvanis, you know, following the conviction of Tom, that they would be fighting this. What have we heard about that? They have now filed an appeal on Tom Silvani's rape conviction. On what grounds are they kind of trying to pull this apart?
It's a little bit technical. There are two grounds, and both linked to the prosecution's evidence involving that phone call that Tom Silvani's victim made to him in the days after the rapes.
Yeah, this is that call we spoke about earlier where Tom Silvani told her not to pursue this any further, right?
Yeah. So in these appeal documents that we've seen, Tom Silvani's lawyers argue that the judge erred in determining statements that Tom Silvani made during that call constituted as incriminating conduct. And they also said that the judge erred in his directions to the jury concerning how the jury was meant to use that evidence to form their verdict.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, you know, again, thinking about who is involved in this, you know, someone with access to a lot of resources. We've already heard they had a couple of lawyers representing them throughout this whole process as well. And previously, when I've seen appeals filed, often they're left until the last possible day of the appeal window. This one has come what seems to be quite quickly in this process as well. So what happens from here?
Well, for now, we're waiting to see if this appeal gets up, but Tom Silvani remains in jail.
Okay. Alex, thank you so much for joining us on The Case Of.
Thanks, Stocky.
If you have any questions about this trial or anything else that we are working on, please get in touch. You can send us an email, thecaseof@abc.net.au. On Thursday this week, following a number of your emails about the retrial of Greg Lynn, we're going to be diving into that story as well, looking at what's happened with his murder conviction and what the path to a retrial looks like for Greg Lynn. The Case Of is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. This episode was reported by Alexandra Alvaro, presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller, and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. This episode was produced on the land of the Wurundjeri people.